Center. I was premature. I didn't turn. All right, going to try this one more time. Good afternoon. We're going to call to order the State Departments and Veteran Budget Division for Tuesday, February 26th, 2013. It's about 3:14. We don't have a quorum yet. Members, today we're going to have a budget review from the Department of Administration and then presentations by Minnesota Public Radio, the Arts Board, Ampers, and Minnesota Public Television. In your package, you're going to find the agenda, change items for the Department of Administration, so we don't need our budget books today, spreadsheets for the Department of Administration and the Arts Board, and handouts for individual presentations. I'd like to ask that you leave the change items with the committee today so that we can put them in your budget books. We are going to start with the Department of Administration. Welcome, Commissioner Kronk. Good to see you again.
See you, too.
And if you would state your name for the record and start your review. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Spencer Kronk, the Commissioner for the Department of Administration. It's a pleasure to be here before you today. I want to, first of all, thank you for your participation in the tour that we recently took of the beautiful Minnesota State Capitol. I hope you got some insights into some of the work that's needed to be done to preserve this beautiful building for the next 100 years. I'm here today, though, to provide an overview of the department's budget. Admin did provide an agency overview to this committee in January, so I'll try to keep my remarks brief before going into the governor's proposed recommendations. As you remember, our mission at the Department of Administration is to provide the best value in government administrative services by emphasizing customer satisfaction, continuous improvement, and employee engagement. We evaluate all of our divisions on a quarterly basis from strategic objectives that really reflect these three core values. Department Administration has this extensive legacy of reform and efficiency. Back in 1937, Governor Stassen created the department to really fix the administrative services for state government. We've been working towards that reform and efficiency mission for the next decades. This department really was founded on that idea that we could use economies of scale, specialized expertise, and other strategies to get the best value from our government services. And through the use of these detailed business plans and performance objectives, admin has developed a litmus test to ensure that it's achieving its mission of providing the best value in government administrative services. I listed a few of those results there, but we have seen that property and casualty insurance operation rates are well below industry standards, and that's allowed the department to return $2.5 million in dividends to agencies and others insured by the state. We've reduced the capital complex energy consumption by 18.1% and have been able to keep agency lease rates relatively stable. And admin has created savings and cost avoidance of over $12.1 million in the last fiscal year through strategic vendor negotiations, and an additional $6.5 million was saved through real estate lease negotiations. Although we have 15 different business units, we can generally categorize them in the following areas. Those that provide citizen services, for example, we've trained and resources for more than 3,000 individuals. We have procurement services, which is used to purchase over $2.1 billion annually. We have facilities management services, construction and space leasing services, government management services, and government-to-government services. This is overall to provide the broad scope and range of services that the department provides. At a glance, our budget is currently proposed at $345.9 million in operating funds. But as you'll see in the next few slides, a small sliver of that, 5%, is from the general fund. So today, as we look at our current appropriations and proposed change items, you'll see a continued focus on reform, innovation, and efficiency. And our operating budget is about 5% of our overall total budget. A key point that I want to make sure that I leave you today with is that the core purpose of admin is to help make government better and for the state to stretch its dollar. We're eager to work with the legislature and with agencies across state and local government to provide new ways to accomplish this goal. For the past 5 years, the department has been able to absorb a decrease in general fund appropriations through cost reductions and increased efficiencies. A few of the services that are a part of our general fund operating expenses include those procurement and contract oversight services, the construction and project management services, our continuous improvement lean program, data practices, our archaeology demography services. The largest chunk of our operating costs come from our fee-for-service funds, which is 87% of our operating funds. These include specialized services for state agencies, but they're really about the leveraging economies of scale, expertise, and coordinated strategies. The results, again, as I mentioned, $1.2 million in energy savings through increased energy efficiency throughout the capital complex, and we've really been able to keep our lease rates low and other rates as well. We do an annual business plan for each of our services, and we manage them very effectively. We also have 8% of our
operating... Excuse me, Commissioner, we have a quorum.
Sure. Great. Thank you very much. 8% of our operating funds are grants, federal, or pass-through funds, and this includes the Council on Developmental Disabilities or the STAR or Assistive Technology Program. And included in that is we act as the fiscal agent for public broadcasting grants, which you'll hear from those organizations later in this committee. I wanted to provide these next two slides just to give you a snapshot of the different divisions that admin oversees and the relative scale of how large they are. For example, our plant management services, which you'll see many of the general maintenance workers and plant building engineers around the Capitol grounds, that division comprises a healthy portion of our department's budget. That primarily is a fee-for-service agent division. Places like the Office of the State Archaeologist is only 1.9 FTEs, and that's a general fund appropriation. So it was relatively useful, hopefully, to see the different the scope and range of the divisions that the agency oversees. Again, the numbers that you see are reflective of what the governor's recommendations are for fiscal year 14 and 15. So with that overview aside, I wanted to dive right into the change items that the governor is proposing. They include the three broad categories of things, items that improve the enterprise efficiency and accountable government services. We'll talk a little bit about capital preservation and restoration. And then I have a placeholder for Minnesota Public Radio because as they are, we are the fiscal agent for their grants, they'll be describing their change item in detail later. So change item number one is a small but strategic increase in our lean continuous improvement program. To date, 10 agencies have instituted a formal continuous improvement effort. 20 agencies have conducted at least one lean continuous improvement event, Kaizen event. But we've trained over 3,500 staff in continuous improvement tools and practices. And over 400 senior leaders have participated in lean leadership symposiums. This is an incredible return on investment for the state. And as you can see, we estimate about $105,000 in savings and 66% time reduction average per Kaizen event. This is a where small investments go a long way in helping to make sure that the state is doing all their services in an efficient manner. In my agency overview in January, we were able to bring in Tom Bauman, the director of the Lean Continuous Improvement Program, and provide a few examples. I listed a couple of them on this slide, and I'm happy to describe them in more detail, but it's really about how to cut any waste or any duplicative services from these programs that are not benefiting the end user. And so as you can see, a Kaizen event that helped out the personal care attendant appeal process at DHS reduced the time that it took to finish an appeal from 87 days to 29 days. It reduced in hours of staffing from 11 to 7, and it estimated amount of savings was almost $1 million annually. We also did a Kaizen event recently with Dolly and their construction trades licensing. As you can see, the state issues or renews over 53,000 licenses annually, And after the event, they were able to reduce the time it took to grant a new license from 29 days to 10 days and from 10 days to 4 days for renewals. These are real numbers and real savings that the end user sees when they're applying for grants or services from the state. Unless there are questions, I'll just go into change item two, which
is... Any questions for the commissioner? Thank you, Commissioner. Go ahead.
Change item two regards our SMART program. It stands for Small Agency Resource Team. An annual appropriation of $250,000 was made in fiscal year 2008 to establish this program within the department. That appropriation supports three FTEs to provide day-to-day HR and financial management services to a portion of the state's small agencies, boards, and councils. This program is important because it allows small agencies to share accounting and HR professionals rather than each of them hiring somebody on their own. It's been well received by these small agencies and has resulted in immediate improvements in internal controls through the separation of duties. And the rate of savings achieved through SMART is currently at 40% when compared to the cost for each of those small agencies to perform the same duties independently.
Excuse me, Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I see they answered my question on the next page, that is who the SMART clients are.
And I think that was my question, too. I was wondering who some of those small agencies might be.
Right there.
All right, very good. Thank you.
So, again, the goal of this change item is to extend this program to add additional agencies. Despite the recommendations for increased SMART appropriations by both Governor Pulenzi and Governor Dayton each biennium, the program funding has remained stagnant since 2008. However, the need for the program still exists. This has prevented SMART from benefiting other agencies who are perfect candidates for the program. For example, the Tax Court, which is an agency with fewer than six FTEs, has been asking for these services since 2011. So it's not a large transformational effort, but it's a common sense change we need to make to continue to drive our costs down and enable state agencies to focus on their resources, on their core statutory missions where they can have the greatest impact. The next slide does detail some of the services that we provide through the SMART program, both on the HR side and the financial management side. And then, as your question, Senator Rest, was, current SMART clients are listed on that slide as well. I'll just say a little bit. We recently completed a report to the legislature that discussed the opportunity for the expanded use of SMART, and if we do expand the program, it would be done so. We would do it so by targeting the general fund appropriation to the smallest agencies, which have less than 10 FTEs with the greatest need. We would then identify support for other state small agencies, such as matching them up with a larger agency. For example, Explore Minnesota program is currently supported by Deed, and there might be good programs or clients that would be matched to an appropriate agency. And then third, there are some SMART services that could be arranged through a fee-for-service type arrangement.
Excuse me, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I've not seen this one small business or small agency called Ombudsman for Families. Can you give me kind of an idea what that's about?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Senator, Mr. Chair. You'd like to know what the actual duties of the Ombudsman for Families include?
Just a thumbnail sketch.
Sure. I'm actually going to bring she doesn't even. This is Lenore Madigan, the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Administration.
Ms. Madigan, would you introduce yourself and for the tape and go ahead.
Lenore Madigan with the Department of Administration, Chairman, members. The Families Group has several groups that work together there, and they provide services to a number of communities throughout Minnesota. I don't work firsthand with them, so I don't have immediate information on what they do, but I certainly could send you some if that would be helpful.
That would be great. I appreciate that.
Great.
Any other questions right now? Okay.
Thanks. The third change item is around an internal audit function, again, a small but strategic investment for the agency. Admin used to have an internal auditor. That funding left almost a decade ago. But because we're such a unique and diverse agency, this is a critical service that we would need to provide. So we're requesting the expertise of an internal auditor to make sure that our functions are guided appropriately. This means prioritizing financial risk within admin. And as you saw before, we have quite a range of operations from demography to lean to these large enterprise businesses like fleet services and risk management workers' compensation. So the auditor would take care of things like the claim payments, card management services, bond-funded construction projects, facilities management, help us really ensure that we have appropriate and accurate financial data and accountability. The addition of this staff person will strengthen our financial controls across all business functions and enhance the agency's financial oversight and accountability.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I have in front of me the OLA's report on the Department of Administration Internal Controls and Compliance Audit. This is a recent one completed for October 25th of 2012, and they had one finding in your response, and it had to do with the monitoring of grants, I think, as you recall. And it, in your response, you indicated that the target date for resolving that finding was in with regard to the public television grant agreements was December 15, 2012, and annual certification of equipment purchases, August 30th, 2013. I wonder how much progress has been made on the on those findings. You indicated that the with regard to the monitoring visits of the grantees and so on, that has been accomplished. I just wonder if you would comment on that for the record.
Mr. Kroc.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, yes, indeed, and I appreciate you bringing up that audit, and certainly we have made significant progress on it, and I think to the recommendations that were made and what our response was, we're certainly on track for that. There was one piece that still needed to be resolved, and that was the report that was due in August of this coming year. But other than that, we were working on it even before that audit was published, because our team was in close consultation with the OLA.
So, Mr. Chairman, when they do, in the future, when they do another internal controls audit of your agency, that finding will not appear. Is that what you?
Correct.
Mr. Kroc.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, that's
it's
correct.
It's going away. Thank you.
And you know, that audit did find that admin was what had generally adequate, but we were resolving that one finding.
It's just one finding, but it's one finding is one finding too many.
I agree.
Okay, are you finished with change item 3?
Yes, with change item 3.
Okay, any other questions on that? Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
I'll quickly move through change items 4 and 5 because I believe the chair had talked about potentially another session just on the capital restoration. So I'll touch on this briefly, but these change items relate to this historic project that we're undergoing, and there is some costs that are impacted on the general fund regarding rent loss, reallocation, and waiving historic places expenses. The governor recommends providing coverage of the rent loss and relocation expenses that will be incurred during this project, because these are non-bondable expenses like utilities, physical move costs, IT relocation. But this funding is required to ensure the restoration of the Capitol building. The waiving depreciation and bond interest for the state facilities that are on the National Register of Historic Places, which would allow the administration to have the capital preservation work proceed without disproportionately assigning the approximately $12.7 million in annual debt services to the Capitol building tenants. Otherwise, those bond, the annual debt service would be added to your rent, and we want to make sure that their rent is stable enough so people can move back into the building itself.
Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Kronk, when we did that tour, it wasn't you, but somebody talked about trying to figure out how we're going to be in the Capitol, in the House chambers, and in the Senate chambers while all this remodeling is going on. From the legislative point of view, we don't have to meet every other year. I mean, every year. We could potentially not meet next year. And I'm wondering if there was has been any discussion about that from your end. If there has been, what kind of savings would be generated as far as in speed of getting it done and maybe us not being here on the every other year?
Mr. Kronk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I know that we've been in ongoing conversations with the team that's doing these working groups on the different areas, including swing space and the potential for moving out of the building. I'm going to actually bring up Wayne Wislosky, our Director of Real Estate and Construction Services, because he's been closer to that conversation than I have.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazalka, Wayne, for the record, Wayne Wislosky, Director of Real Estate and Construction Services with the Department of Administration. This is closely tied to the overall schedule and in the sequencing of the work. Currently, we're still working under, and this was actually put into statute that as part of the bill that was passed last year, that essentially we have to operate under the premise that the chambers have to be stay operational during the regular legislative sessions. But your question has been asked a number of times, how much money could we save? So we have asked the construction manager to evaluate that and how much funds could be saved if we were able to essentially skip one off operating budget years. And what would that? How would that impact the overall schedule?
Senator Gazalka.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So when we, if we're going to bring have a conversation on this in the future, maybe we should at least know that data and talk about it. And you know, if we had to, we could extend the session a couple months if we needed to squeeze a bonding bill in. Or but at least so we know, you know, whether that's worthwhile doing or not.
And Mr. Dzlosky, would you think we'd know that sometime in the not-too-distant future?
Mr. Chair, we certainly can do that. We can. We're getting farther down the road on defining how the work would be sequenced, so we should be able to put good estimates to how much time would be saved and therefore how much money would be saved.
And I do think that, we're going to – we will obviously have some time in this session, and so when you're ready, maybe we should have another meeting, as the commissioner was referring to. Be good.
Mr. Chair, we'd certainly welcome that opportunity.
Great. Good. All right, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Somewhat of a placeholder, but did want to mention change item 6, which is a small increase for MPR, or Minnesota Public Radio infrastructure. They'll be describing that change item when they give their presentation later today. But because we're a fiscal agent for this grant, it was important to include that part of our change items as well. Want to conclude with just reiterating that our operating budget change items have an enterprise impact. These are what I consider small but strategic investments in really helping other state agencies think about their operations in a more efficient and accountable manner. So with that, I'll stand for any final questions.
Questions for the commissioner?
Chairman.
Yes, Senator Metzen.
Yeah, I think very unrelated, but Commissioner, is it your department that who pays the bond reductions on our bonds that the state has issued?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'll be corrected if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that where the bonds are appropriated, those agencies have the responsibility for paying them back on their own. So, for example, MMB is, okay.
Oh, MMB is, okay. I guess just to follow up on that, and maybe
yes, Senator Metzen.
It's not for use, Commissioner, but I mean, these bonds have been, the favorable ratings the last year or so, or year and a half, has been like 2.5, 2.8, and below 3% for a period of time. And I'm just wondering if who was ever responsible for making these payments have negotiated or reissued, if you will. I know some municipalities have reissued these bonds and have saved a lot of money. And I just thought I'd throw that out for discussion. And maybe it's happening. And if it is, that's wonderful. I don't know that.
Refinancing
is, yeah. So maybe it's being done and I just don't know about it. But I know a couple of cities that I represent have been rewriting their bonds and have been saving a lot of money. So somebody check that out.
Commissioner, you want to comment on it?
Just briefly, Mr. Chair, Senator, I know that this is, our CFO was reminding me that this is MMB, and I'm reminded of a news item that they put out, I think, in the last 4 months, that they were able to renegotiate and refinance their bonds and save the state about $50 million. I'll get you an exact number, but it is an ongoing process, and we're always constantly thinking about how to get a better rate for that.
That's what I thought, but it's a good question to make sure that we're doing it, Mr. Chairman and members. Yeah. It's a substantial amount of money. I mean, it's a lot of.
Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, Senator Metzen, tomorrow the Capital Investment Committee will hear a presentation from MMB. Kristen Hansen will address that very issue.
Oh, Eric, people are
thank you,
ahead
Stumpf.
Of me, I guess.
Other questions for the commissioner? If not, Commissioner, we appreciate you coming back, and we'll probably see you again, if for no other reason, because we should discuss the capital restoration.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Next, Lisa Radzik with Minnesota Public Radio. Ms. Radzik, please identify yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Saxhog, members of the committee. Thank you for being here and for giving us your time. For the record, my name is Lisa Radzek. I am the Managing Director of Public Affairs and Government Relations for Minnesota Public Radio. I am here today on behalf of Minnesota Public Radio and the million listeners that tune in to NPR each week. Behind me you'll see, and also on the handouts that were in your packets, the back page of the two stapled sheets, you'll see the map of the state, and you'll see that we are made up of nearly 80 stations and translator stations that cover more than 95% of the population in Minnesota.
Thank you.
We are the only broadcaster that it serves the entire state of Minnesota. We are requesting $500,000 from the legislature for our Greater Minnesota General Fund Equipment Grant. As Commissioner Kronk alluded to, that is a $120,000 increase from the FY12-13 biennium grant that we received. Why are we asking for an increase? This would bring us to the level that we had received in the FY12-13 FY10 and 11 biennium. Blanketing the entire state of Minnesota, NPR provides a radio signal where other public radio stations don't, from very small communities to the large metro areas. We invest our general fund equipment grants only for the purpose of building and maintaining our Greater Minnesota network of stations. None of our general fund dollars get spent inside the Twin Cities metro area. With 43 stations throughout Minnesota and 40 translator stations, our Greater Minnesota infrastructure requires constant maintenance and repair. In addition, many of these stations and translators are 40-plus years old. Technologies have changed rapidly, and it is this critical equipment, the transmitters, the antennas, the microwave systems, that have begun to age and are in need of repair. It is this large network of stations that allows NPR to serve as the backbone to the EAS and Amber Alert systems. We work closely with the State Department of Public Safety, Homeland Security, and local emergency responders to fulfill our unique role as the backbone to the Emergency Alert and Amber Alert system. So what does it mean to be the backbone to the Emergency Alert and Amber Alert system? It means that we are the only entity.
Excuse me.
Yes, sir.
So this past week when we had this Amber Alert, Tell us how you were involved in that.
We would have been, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, how NPR would have been involved in that is the emergency responders on the ground would have sent the appropriate signal to the Department of Public Safety's their subunit, I'm forgetting the name right now, Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, excuse me, they, which happened to be right across the street from us, would have sent a signal directly to NPR and inside our ICC, which is the International Control Center. There is a ability to flip a switch, and immediately all the stations which you see on the map behind you, and including all other broadcasters in the state that are tuned into us, they're monitoring our signal according to FCC regulations, would see the signal and interrupt their programming so that on the radio or on TV or through other broadcasting means, cable, which would be through the TV, would then have the message.
iPhone?
iPhone is separate.
Separate.
Okay. The iPhone system is separate, but the signal would have gone to us at the same time it went to the okay. phones.
Thank you.
You bet. So what it means to be the backbone to the emergency alert system is just that. As you see before you, our map and what I just described, we blanket the entire state. So when we send out a message, the entire state gets it at once, whereas in many states they don't have that, they're not in that position. So they'll have more of a daisy chain effect to get the message out, and it will take a longer time, and there just leads to greater problems. That's the only testimony I had for you. You see on the handout some examples of what we use the general fund appropriation for on the back page of the second, on the first sheet, the second side of the first sheet. Either myself or our network managers from Greater Minnesota, we've tried to meet with all of you, or will soon, and I believe we've answered your questions, and I'm happy to answer additional questions now.
Questions for Ms. Radzik? Yes. Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Radzik, I'm just trying to get a handle on this. So NPR has the public funding piece of it, correct? And then the public grants, and you have some private dollars come in from other sources. I should do this so I can see what you got up there. Okay. So could you not handle the capital improvements through your own private dollars come in and private support instead of coming back here? Because there are other stations that operate throughout the state, AMPRs, that could use some resources for their stuff. So couldn't this be funded in a different way? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chamberlain, it's a great question. The places where the funds are invested, let me give you some examples really quickly so you'll just have a feel for what I'm going to get at here. Collegeville, St. Peter, Moorhead, Rochester, probably not as much in Rochester, but the other ones that I mentioned, and then many more. These are areas of the state where there's not a large population, and so what you have is the inability to raise funds privately in those smaller communities. But we believe, and I believe the state also believes that doesn't mean that those communities are any less important in terms of having a consistent broadcast signal, including the what we provide for the emergency and amber alert systems.
Senator Chamberlain.
Just one follow-up. Thank you. So, again, I'm trying to understand how these funds flow. I understand sometimes funds come into an organization and they're allotted. They had to go to different slots and silos, and they had to be spent in certain places. So all these other stations around the state, they are affiliated with NPR and are under that umbrella, part of the NPR operation. So is it not possible for the NPR dollars that come in to be allocated out to these different places, or do those cities, towns, and locations, are they required to raise their own funds to make their own repairs? How does that work? Thank you.
Ms. Radzik.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chamberlain, we could take the pot of funds that we have and send it out to the other stations. I understand your point there. But in terms of when cuts need to be made and we need to make decisions, some of the first things that would go that aren't able to sustain themselves or provide any additional revenue to NPR would be some of those greater Minnesota stations. And we ask the state, we think it's fair to ask the state to partner with us for some of the costs that come with making sure there's electricity at the Ely station, making sure the Roseau station has the antenna it needs after a harsh winter, making sure Worthington has what it needs for electricity and a cooling unit. So that's what I'm getting at, that that's those. It's important to us to partner with the state so we make sure they still have the services that they need in those communities.
One more follow-up. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm understanding this better now. So at what point, again, trying to understand this, at what point do we decide or who decides that NPR has given enough to their own support structure and that the state should give in? And is there a percentage in there somewhere, or what's the measurement process to say, well, NPR is given X percent, so therefore the state should give another X percent to support these? So what's that matrix, and how does that look? What does that look like? Thank you.
Ms. Rancic.
That'll be all. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Chamberlain.
Senator Chamberlain, or Senator Saxhog, Senator Chamberlain, I'm not sure I have an answer for you. I think that's something that you all would decide.
Thank you.
Other questions?
I appreciate Senator Saxon. Someone's lovely water bottle left here.
Yeah, and I can't.
It wasn't mine. I just want to say that I appreciate the additional advertisement here before me.
But Senator Anderson has another question.
Oh, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rancic, it says in the proposal that the improvements are for strengthening NPR's network of stations, and if this change is adopted, the NPR's engineering team will have more resources to strengthen and repair aging equipment. And yet, down on the bottom, it says that you're going to be replacing transmitters in Rochester, auxiliary antenna, and a transmitter replacement in Brainerd. I thought that means new equipment, and I thought the way it was presented, it wasn't going to be new equipment, it was going to be for repairing only. But maybe I'm mistaken.
Ms. Rancic.
Chairman Saxhog, Senator Anderson, I hope that there's no materials that represent that there wouldn't be purchasing of new equipment to replace that which needed to be replaced. Certainly we would use the funds when the requirement for the repair is to replace the specific piece. If that makes sense for you. New equipment for the nature of replacing that which is now outdated, totally broken and unusable, et cetera. So that's where replacement would come in. Did that answer your question, sir?
Other questions from Ms. Rancic? No, thank you for your testimony, and we appreciate it. Next, we're going to go to the Arts Board. Sue Jens, Executive Director of the Arts Board, is with us. And Jeff Prower, Executive Director of the Metropolitan Regional Arts Board. Ms. Jens, if you want to identify yourself and go ahead, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I am Sue Jens. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Arts Board. My co-presenter today, Jeff Prower, from the Metropolitan Regional Arts Councils, representing the 11 regional arts councils that exist in the state of Minnesota. We are planning to give you a brief overview of what we do, the Arts Board and the Regional Arts Councils. We're planning to present to you what the governor has proposed in his budget for 2014-15, and give you a few snapshots of the ways that we invest those funds. You have a handout from us that has the slides. I want to make the slides rather. There we go. I'm not a technology person. The Arts Board is a state agency. The state of Minnesota created an arts council within state government in 1903. We were the second state to do so. We've been through a lot of changes in those 100-some years. The current structure and current name was put in place in 1977. The Regional Arts Council system was created then. We think it's a great addition. It's one of the unique things about Minnesota, one of the things that makes this state more effective in many ways. You have our mission statement there from Minnesota statutes, which is to stimulate and encourage the creation, performance, and appreciation of the arts in the state. Our duties and responsibilities are also in Chapter 129D. We have 9 or 10 duties spelled out, and chief among them is to provide grants and financial assistance that make the arts available throughout the state of Minnesota. We have a board of 11 members. They represent the 8 congressional districts. We have 3 members who serve at large, all of whom are appointed by the governor and then approved by the Senate, we hope this year. We have a staff of 18 FTEs, and we rely very heavily on volunteers. We have the authority to appoint advisory committees. We recruit 250 to 300 people a year who come in. They review all of the grant applications. They discuss them in open public meetings. They rank the proposals, and then they make recommendations to our board. We think it's one of the really important strengths of the process that we use for reviewing financial assistance requests. I'm going to hand off to Jeff to have him describe the Regional Arts Council system.
Mr. Prower.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jeff Prower. I'm the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Regional Arts Council, located in St. Paul. We are one of the 11 Regional Arts Councils that serve all 87 counties of Minnesota. Minnesota is unique in that it's the only state of the 50 that has regional arts councils that are established for the primary purpose of working in partnership with the State Arts Council to deliver funds and services to all 87 counties, to all the counties of the state. We work in partnership with the Arts Board and with one another. The 11 regional arts councils have a forum of regional arts councils that meets on a regular basis to compare notes, to talk about best practices, and to discuss mutual issues that might improve our service and, more importantly, might improve access to the arts for everyone in the state of Minnesota. We submit a biennial plan to the State Arts Board every 2 years that is approved or not by the State Arts Board. We don't proceed until our biennial plan is approved by the State Arts Board. So we work very closely in partnership and also with the Arts Board's oversight.
One of the things that I would mention is that one of the 9 duties spelled out in state statute is that the Arts Board is the fiscal agent for the Regional Arts Councils, but all of their grant making is locally based, so their boards have final authority for making decisions about those grants. Collectively,
excuse,
we all work.
Excuse me, Senator Rest.
Pardon me.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a number of questions about the legislative audit to report with regard to the regional arts councils, and I don't know when you is appropriate for me to ask that.
And so I might ask you, Ms. Jens, if we have a few questions in terms of the audit, would that be best done now or at the end?
I'll leave that to you, Mr. Chair, whether you would like to take questions along the way or save them for the end.
Well, let's take care of it right now, then.
Okay.
Senator.
Ms. Jones, I have the audit report on internal controls that was completed and released last fall. And in particular, there were questions that were raised with regards to the oversight of the regional arts councils and stating things like they did not in their financial statements, they didn't separately account for the state grant monies, including the Arts and Cultural Heritage Funds, and one of them could not account for how much of over $626,000 was generated from unspent or unobligated state grant funds. And as you know, when they have those regional councils, when they have unobligated funds, they're supposed to return them. And there was a plan from one of them that just said, well, they'll think they'll keep it, but they can't do that. They have to obligate everything. And I was wondering, I note your response, but I was wondering, you're saying that the response to it or the resolution of it is going to occur by June 30th of 2013, but I wondered how much progress you're making on monitoring the the financial reports of the grantees, but also of the regional arts councils, so that they are they're acting in accord with state policies with regard to financial reporting.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, we take our responsibilities for accountability and stewardship very seriously, and we are working to address that. The question that you raised, first of all, about the auditor's report and the Regional Arts Council, I think you said not accounting separately for the funds. Mm-hmm. The situation was that they produce a fiscal report that shows how the funds were spent, but it was not perfectly in line with the way their chart of accounts was recording the dollars in their financial statements. And so that was one of the weaknesses that the auditors said should be fixed, is that those chart of accounts, financial statements should align perfectly with the reports that they could provide to us.
And so, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Gens, has that been done?
Mr. Chair, yes. Senator Rest, yes.
So that part of it has
that
been
that piece of it has been
completed.
Done.
The
yes.
chart of accounts now reflects accurately the separation of those funds.
The financial statements for the agency would then be able to be lined up with the reports that are produced and provided to the Arts Board.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. So with regard to another part of the finding, with regard to individual artists and arts organizations, you had mentioned in your response that there are, I think there's some 500 to 600 that you grant every year, and that during this period of the audit, that process was all done manually, and so you had a technology deficiency, and that you were going to be rectifying that with a more streamlined process that did indeed use technology, and so I want to know, how is it going?
Ms. Jens.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, the part of the report that you're referring to now was not specifically about regional arts councils. It was about other grant making.
Yes. This is another part of it.
Yes.
But it's still part of internal controls.
It is. Yeah. It is. One of the things that happened is that in the first 2 years of the legacy funds, much of this monitoring and tracking information came about because of the pretty significant increase in our workload with legacy funds. Our budget increased almost 200%. Our staff size obviously did not increase 200%. We increased it a little bit. We also were going through the state shutdown at the end of fiscal 2011, and we were sending out notices for reports coming due manually. We had a disruption of that service. What we are in the process of doing, you asked how are we doing, we have moved to a new, what they call a life cycle grants management system. It's an outside vendor that can do everything from take in the grant applications electronically, have panelists read the materials electronically, have the system send out a report reminder when it's coming due, and then can collect the report information electronically so that all of it gets stored in the same system. And we're implementing that system this year. We think that will be a piece of the solution, but we also are focusing on our staff resources and how we're following up with monitoring visits and processing final reports. And we actually are talking with members of the legacy committees, because in the 12-13 legacy bill, agencies were given the flexibility and the authority to decide what administrative costs they needed to use to provide stewardship for those funds. The Arts Board was one of two agencies in the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund that still was given a cap on administrative costs. So we've talked with the chairs of the committees and other members to see whether we could get a little more flexibility that would help us with workload.
Well, Senator S.
Mr. Chairman, I would be very cautious about how much flexibility you'd be given with regard to administrative costs that are not accounted for, and we, I think the legislative auditor in another report commented on that there was just a blanket percentage, and then you didn't ask people how they actually were spending the money, and that's As you know, we're very jealous about those funds, and that's very important. But I didn't think that you actually answered my question. Is that life cycle grants management system that you referenced, is it in place and is it fully implemented?
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Jens.
Senator Rust, it is not fully implemented yet. We are implementing it this fiscal year. So we're beginning to use it this fiscal year.
So, Senator Mr. Chairman and Ms. Jens, so do you intend that it be fully implemented by July 1st of this year?
Mr. Chair? Senator Rust.
Ms. Jens.
We intend for the application pieces of it and the review pieces to be fully implemented by the end of this fiscal year. And we will be working on all of the reporting functions and the monitoring functions, and those will be fully implemented by next year. It doesn't mean that we aren't going to also continue to do manual things, the manual processes that we have in place. But moving fully to the new system will take us more than 6 months. It'll take us a few more months. So we'll be fully into it by next year.
Senator Rest.
Hope next year when I ask that question, you'll say, we're all done. Yes.
All right, Senator.
Thank you, great. Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Jens.
Senator Rest, may I say, I agree with you. We are really eager to have the system in place, and we're looking forward to it helping us in many ways.
Senator.
Mr. Chairman, yes. You know, 500 to 600 grants, all of which look different, going to different places, et cetera. You really do need an automated system to depend upon a limited number of employees to do that is totally unrealistic.
Ms. Jens,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll move quickly. Our purpose, the Arts Board and Regional Arts Councils together, is that we want all Minnesotans to be able to benefit from the arts, whether that means going to a concert or a museum or being in a community theater production or benefiting in other ways. Your task is to set the state's operating budget, and there are many people who say, well, why should there even be an investment in the arts in the state's operating budget? Why is there a state agency? It doesn't belong. It's not a priority. The reason we're here, we believe, is because Minnesotans really do care about the arts. They believe that the arts are important to our quality of life. They believe that they're important to the education of our young people. And Minnesotans really do participate in the arts. They want to be able to have high-quality activities available to them. I'll go quickly through this next section because you obviously have all been through this process. But one of the things that was new about the biennial planning process this year, and this is only my sixth time through this cycle, was that there were a set of statewide outcomes set by the governor and the commissioner of finance and others. And each state agency was asked to identify those outcomes that it felt it was helping to achieve. And we identified three, and I will deal with these quite quickly. One is we believe that the arts contribute to a thriving economy. The nonprofit arts industry that we serve has about 1,400 arts organizations, 15,000 to 20,000 individual artists who operate as sole proprietors. They contribute about $1 billion of economic activity, either direct expenses, related spending, or local and state sales tax revenue. The second outcome we identified is education and skills building, skills for the future. Each year, the College Board analyzes SAT scores, and it shows consistently that students who study the arts in high school score higher on their SAT scores, at least 100 points higher than students who do not study the arts. It has a lot to do with the cognitive skills that are built in the arts. Another little piece of information that we uncovered recently is that IBM did a survey of 1,500 CEOs across the country and asked them to identify the most important competency that they thought would be important for success in business in the future. And the number one factor is creativity. Practicing the arts develops creativity. The third outcome we identified with is strong and stable families and communities. Pardon me. Whether you look at the Lowertown District where our office is, or if you look at Northeast Minneapolis where artists are reclaiming abandoned warehouses and industrial buildings, whether you look at Lanesboro or New York Mills or Fergus Falls where the arts are used as an anchor to rebuild Main Street, the arts help build neighborhoods and communities. And the state demographer this week just talked about how we are becoming more racially and ethnically diverse. As we do so, it'll be the stories, the songs, the dances, and the customs from those traditions that bring us together. This is a snapshot of our general fund appropriations over the last decade or so. You'll see that the high water mark was in 2002, 2003. We were at about $25 million from the general fund. We took a very significant decrease in 04, 05. It was about a third of the appropriation. And I will say quite candidly that I think that motivated a lot of people in the arts community to look at something like the Legacy Amendment as a really important, important thing to put in place. The right-hand column is you'll see the governor's proposed budget for 14-15 is level funding. So we were very pleased that he has proposed to keep us at the same level for the coming 2 years. Very briefly, what do we do with those dollars? Here is the breakdown of how the general fund dollars are being spent this year, and the governor is proposing this same breakdown for 14-15. So that's what his bill would look like. The regional arts councils decide how to divide up the funds that are allocated to them. They come up with a formula based principally on population, an equal share, but also geographic area. If one region has a much larger area and needs to reimburse people to come to board meetings and things, they need some extra money for travel. The Arts Board, I'll skip to the bottom line. Operations and services is some of the services that we provide to the community. We don't do a lot of that, but it's also the administrative dollars that we're able to use from general fund. And you'll see that most of the money that we control goes into two grant programs. We invest in operating support for high-quality arts organizations, and we invest in individual artists. So if you think about it like the Fortune 500s and the small individual and small businesses, that's kind of the way to think about it. It's the core of the success of the arts community in the state of Minnesota. For more than two decades, we have been providing operating support to arts organizations. Right now, it's about 150 all across the state. It's organizations that that all of us in the room would know, like the Minneapolis Institute of Arts and the Guthrie. That's not only a statewide institution, but a nationally recognized institution. But we also support very small organizations and very specialized organizations like the North House Folk School in Grand Marais or the Chinese Dance Theater here in the Twin Cities. We support organizations throughout the state, the Rife Center in Grand Rapids, St. Francis Music School in Little Falls, the Great River Shakespeare Festival in Winona, the Paul Bunyan Playhouse in Bemidji, the Mankato Symphony. We support organizations that are focused on children, like CLIMB or the Children's Theater, organizations that serve seniors, and organizations that bring the arts to people with disabilities, like VSA and Interact.
Ms. Jens, we have a question from Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How does the individual artists tap into some of the resources available? Do they have to be part of some of these regional groups, or is there a way to them for them to tap in directly?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazalka, thank you. I was just about to talk about individual artists. Individual artists may apply to the Arts Board directly. We make grants in eight artistic disciplines, and we do an annual deadline. It is our most competitive grant program. We receive 700 to 800 applications from individuals every year. Each of the regional arts councils also funds individuals, and they're doing that with funding that they receive from the McKnight Foundation. So there are two different ways that an individual could look at being funded. Sometimes the programs are very different. What they can do with those dollars and how they can be used is very different. In the case of the Arts Board, the funds need to be used for career development. There's some new skill that an artist wants to learn or some way that he or she wants to reach a broader audience. Or it might be a project that is connects with the community. We had an artist who helped worked with a group of local teens in northeast Minneapolis to build a sculpture in a community park. It might be someone who wants to celebrate a particular cultural tradition. We have an artist, and I'll pick on Senator Gazalka in Little Falls, who wanted to form a Slavic women's chorus and has been arranging Slavic folk music for that organization to be able to perform. And so the idea comes from the artist, and they can propose it either to the Arts Board or to the Regional Arts Council. off to Jeff again.
Thank you. I think the important message here, as this slide shows, is that there's a broad range of ways that regional arts councils provide support to the arts organizations in their communities. But more importantly is the fact that, you know, we often get questions about, well, what kind of art do you support? Is it just visual art? Is it just music? And as you've heard from some of the examples that Sue has provided, the support that's provided by the regional arts councils and the arts board is for all sorts of arts disciplines. You know, we talked about geographic diversity, but also arts discipline diversity. And the other important message that we'd like to convey is that first of all, these are very small grants in most cases, and many times the arts events that are being presented with this money are free to the public.
Two last slides. We know that you are focused on the general fund dollars, but we wanted to give you a fuller picture of our funding. Obviously, the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund has made a significant difference for us. Right now, we're receiving just under $46 million for the biennium from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. In the left side, you see our general fund dollars at $15 million. Part of the reason I give you this slide is that because the Constitution says that legacy funds were to supplement, not substitute for, we have been a little worried that the general fund dollars have gone down now two budget cycles, and we know that the state's budget has some challenges, and that's why we were really pleased that the governor did not recommend a decrease once again, that he's recommending stable funding.
Senator Gazalka has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's clear that Minnesota has a commitment to the arts, whether it comes from the general fund or legacy dollars, but that $60 million there, how does that compare to other states? It's clear we have a commitment. How does it compare if you were to compare it to other states?
Mr. Chair? Senator Gazalka, we are one of the higher states in terms of public funding for the arts, and we are that because Minnesotans voted for the legacy amendment.
Thank you.
And Ms. Jens, when we see these numbers like 43 and 45 million, what would you say was the biggest single change brought forward because of those funds? That couldn't be done prior to that.
Mr. Chair, for me personally, I think the biggest change is that it allowed us to do things that were quite different than what we did before. For example, at the Arts Board, we are now funding a touring program, dedicating funds so that artists can move around the state and share their work, not just in their own home communities. It's also allowed us to create grant programs for health and human service organizations. So the Minnesotans who have perhaps the fewest opportunities to be involved in the arts, the most challenges in their life, perhaps the least economic resources, can now be part of an arts program through a human or social service organization that might be funded. So I think what it's allowed us to do is to continue to fund the arts in their traditional settings, but also fund the arts in places that we see the arts happening but we weren't funding before, like Parks and Rec, senior centers, human service organizations. We're seeing those kind of things being funded in places that we weren't able to do before.
Good. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Jens, you said, I think, earlier that the money that goes out through the grant programs, through the councils, to the different regions and different schools and stuff, it allows it to be free to the public? Is that what I heard you say as far as presentation of whatever activity that might be being done at a school or a local gymnasium or things like that? Is that what I'm hearing?
Ms. Jens?
I think that was Mr. Prower's comment.
Okay.
I'll let him respond.
Mr. Prower?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, yes, that's true in many cases. It's not a requirement of getting a grant that an organization has to provide something free, but in many cases it certainly allows organizations to provide arts activities for free, and certainly in the case of schools, you know, the previous question was about, how have the legacy funds changed the landscape, and In the case of the Metropolitan Regional Arts Council and some of the other regional arts councils, we've been able to establish arts education programs so that there is a lot more happening in schools than there was before the legacy funds were available.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just...
Senator Anderson.
It's kind of interesting to hear you say it. They're free, or it's supposed to be free to the public, and yet every time I've gone to them, they mention at the beginning of the program, after I paid my $15 to get in, that this is a grant that was provided by the Legacy Fund Arts and stuff. So it's curious to me to see that they charge for the public to get in, and yet you just told me it was free. So it's interesting to hear that.
Mr. Breyer.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, if I conveyed that everything funded was free, I was mistaken. Not all activities funded are free, but in many cases they are.
Senator Anderson, you probably were paying with $15. You were probably paying for a $25 ticket.
It's a school play.
Oh well, okay. All right. Any other questions,
Mr. Chair? Okay, we have one last number to share with you. And again, this is a combination of general fund activity and legacy funded activity. But the first 2 years that the legacy funds were available to us, when you add up all of the participants in Arts Board funded activities, Regional Arts Council funded activities, you reach a total of nearly 25 million individuals. Again, from pre-K to senior citizens all over the state of Minnesota, all different kinds of arts activities. So while the general fund dollars, the $15 million out of the general fund budget, might seem small as you think about some of the other agencies and their budget requests, it has a significant impact in the arts community. You asked me before, what's the difference? I've worked in the arts community for 30 years, and what I see now is a lot of excitement about possibilities that hasn't been there before, and not just within arts organizations or individual artists who have been doing this work, but also communities saying, what could the arts do for us? And so I see a lot of excitement. So we see a significant impact on the lives of Minnesotans, on families, on neighborhoods, on communities, and on the state as a whole. And we really appreciate your consideration of the governor's budget for the general fund, and we'll be happy to respond to any additional questions that you might have.
Questions? If not, Ms. Jens, Mr. Power, we appreciate you being here today.
Thank you. We appreciate your time.
Next, we have Association of Minnesota Public Education Radio Stations, better known as AMPRS. And with us today is Joel Glazer, Executive Director for AMPRS, and Maggie Montgomery, Station Manager, KAXE, Grand Rapids. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joel Glazer. I am the Executive Director of AMPRS, the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations.
And hello, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Maggie Montgomery, and I'm General Manager at Northern Community Radio.
We'd like to begin today by, of course, starting off by thanking you not only for inviting us here today, but thanking you for continuing to support our group of community radio stations. AMPRS, which provides diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, is made up of 15 independent, truly local community radio stations around Minnesota. We are not affiliated with, nor do we receive any funding from Minnesota Public Television or Minnesota Public Radio. The AMPRS stations primarily serve rural and minority communities that are not typically reached through traditional media. 14 of the 15 stations qualify for state funding. Since the last biennium, we've had three new stations join the group. All three stations are affiliated with Native American communities in northern Minnesota. They're not just new to AMPRS, they're actually brand new to Minnesota as well. This allows us to serve even more Minnesotans, which of course ties into the need for more funding, which we can support these new stations without reducing the funding and in turn the services that we offer the existing stations. AMPRS is a radio association, not a radio network. You can think of us basically as a trade association. There's a big difference between a radio network and an association. Minnesota Public Radio, for example, is a radio network. That means that if you're in Grand Marais and you can magically also be in Winona at the exact same time, you'd be hearing the exact same programming. Minnesota Public Radio takes their great programming that they produce here in the Twin Cities, and they send it out statewide. The Amper stations are individually programmed by and for their local community. As you will see on our coverage map, we have local community stations as far north as Grand Marais and Thief River Falls, down to Winona, Mankato, and Austin, and just about everything in between. The stations are all licensed either to a college, school, or university, or directly to the communities that they serve. Because Minnesota Public Radio and Ampers are both public radio stations, understandably, there's actually a fair amount of confusion. The two serve very different audiences, very different needs, and in very different ways. The Amper stations are smaller community radio stations. Each one of them only have between 2 to at most 9 full-time employees, relying very heavily on volunteers, in some cases as many as 250 to 300 volunteers. The Amper stations are not rebroadcasting or retransmitting programming from one main station. We don't view Minnesota Public Radio as a competitor. The best analogy would be to think of Minnesota Public Radio as a Target or a Home Depot, providing strong services to the masses. Ampers, on the other hand, we're kind of the small corner drugstore or hardware store where everybody knows your name. We're truly hyper-local. The Amper stations are entrenched in their communities and play a critical role in distributing emergency information. NPR plays an important role by distributing that initial emergency alerts, as you heard from Ms. Radzik. The Amper stations are able to go into significantly more detail before, during, and after an emergency event. They are able to put local police, fire chiefs, and other emergency officials on the air to provide real-time updates, like this interview from KUMD in Duluth after the floods. My apologies here. That same storm knocked out phone lines, internet service in northeast Minnesota, and WTIP in Grand Marais literally put residents on the air to get their personal and business information out to the community since they couldn't call outside of their exchange. In several areas, Amper stations provide the only option for emergency service agencies to get additional urgent and potentially life-saving information out to the public immediately. Mr. Chairman, as you may recall, a different storm system ripped through your area of central Minnesota in July of last year with 80-mile-an-hour winds. It knocked out just about every commercial radio station in the Cass Lake area. Even as a new station, KOJB played a critical role in getting life-saving information out to the community. The station was able to tell listeners about emergency food and water distribution centers. In your packet of information, you'll find a letter of support from Sheriff Tom Birch of Cass County talking about the important role KOJB plays. Senator Dietzick, Senator Champion, all of you for that matter, probably remember the tornadoes that ripped through Minneapolis in May of 2011. Not only did KMOJ provide important information about assistance and cleanup, they actually collected thousands of pounds of food, clothing, and hygiene supplies. Their staff even rolled up their sleeves and set up barbecue pits, cooking food that had been donated for up to 4 days straight. In addition to emergency services and entertainment, the stations also provide a great deal of educational programming and opportunities in their local communities. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm going to let Maggie Montgomery continue to talk about a little about the educational programming.
Ms. Montgomery.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and I'll introduce myself. I'm Maggie Montgomery. I'm general manager of Northern Community Radio,
We serve the area of Grand Rapids, Bemidji, Hibbing, Bagley, Brainerd, and Ely. I'm also vice president of AMPRS. 8 of AMPRS' 15 radio stations are affiliated with colleges, schools, and universities. 2 are licensed to tribes, and 5 are freestanding nonprofits like ours. Those affiliated with educational institutions get very little financial help from their institutions, generally studio space and 1 or 2 employees. All the AMPRS stations have a very strong commitment to education, and I'm going to tell you about a couple of ways our station carries out that commitment. We recently started a youth radio program. The students in our program come from several area high schools, and they just did their very first program last week. They were totally psyched, and they did great job. They produced interviews in advance, and they even wrote original music for part of their show. WTIP in Grand Marais and KFAI in the Twin Cities also have youth radio programs. We also have a program called the Phonology Program on KAXE. This is not phrenology. That's the study of bumps on the head. Phonology is a way we teach kids to observe nature, and it's about the study of natural events as they relate to climate. We bring the program to more than 250 kids in 10 classrooms in towns like Virginia, Crosby, Cherry, Mountain Iron, Grand Rapids, Bemidji, Cross Lake, and Cohasset. Not only do the students get a chance to report their observations on the radio, but the information they're collecting is actually being used in university climate studies, like at Cornell Lab in the University of Minnesota. This year, Northern Community Radio provided broadcast training to 5 college interns and 65 new adult volunteers. So if you look at the back of the AMPRS coverage map, you'll find a table that shows you the stations and the number of students involved in programs at each of the stations. Collectively, we involve more than 1,100 traditional students and more than 300 non-traditional students in what we do. I'd also like to quickly let you know how KAXE used our State of Minnesota block grant, our community service block grant, last year. It doesn't sound super exciting, but it's fundamentally important. We used the community service grant to stay on the air. Last year, we received approximately $20,000 from the state community service grant, and we applied that to the electricity to run our transmitter, which costs us about $25,000 a year. So it paid most of that money, and it means that we can get our signal out to our community. So thank you, Joel.
Mr. Chairman,
thank
members
you,
of the committee.
Montgomery.
Thank you.
Yep.
KAXE is obviously just one example of the 14 stations receiving the funding, but all 14 of the stations use the funding in very similar ways. They use the money to serve their rural and minority communities, communities that you represent. They use it to deliver programming in 11 different languages. Many of those languages aren't heard anywhere else. You'll hear programs in Hmong, in Somali, Oromo, and Ojibwe. The Mankato station produces 6 hours of original Hispanic-Latino programming every Saturday. AMPRS stations have received state community service grants and equipment for more than 30 years. The community service grants help to pay employees to produce local programming relevant and often unique to their local area. Programs about the environment, news and information about events specific to their local community, high school and college sports, and some even broadcast their local city council meetings. They use the money, as Maggie told you, to pay utilities and stay on the air. And some use the community service funding to pay tower rental fees. Equipment dollars are spent on aging audio boards and replacing other aging equipment and replacing equipment to keep up with current technology. Oftentimes, equipment dollars are literally spent to replace frayed duct-taped wires with new wires. In fact, we need the help from this committee in this regard. In the past, we've been able to use equipment dollars to repair, rent, or replace equipment depending on what made the most sense financially. But the appropriation language has always specifically said the funds are to be used for the purchase of equipment. So the money can't be used for repairs, even if the repair is the best option. So you will see in our legislative agenda that we are looking to get that changed. At the request of the Department of Administration, we are also looking to change the wording in the statute for eligibility because much of the language is extremely vague and difficult for them to execute. At the top of our legislative agenda, you will find the request, and you will see what we received in the last biennium as well as what we are requesting for the next biennium. While it doesn't appear on paper for the equipment grant, what we are requesting is actually flat. It's flat if you look at it on a per-station basis because of the three new Native American stations. These funds are not appropriated directly to AMPERS. They are granted directly to the station, which is why we are asking you to look at it on a per-station basis. A $234,000 appropriation will fund all 14 stations equally, funding the three new stations and keeping the original 11 stations flat from the previous biennium. The same is true for the community service grant. However, we are asking for an increase in that area so that we can start to disseminate emergency information in foreign languages. As you heard earlier in testimony, there was an Amber Alert, and you're probably aware, that went out last week. Everyone involved was of Latino-Hispanic descent, the child, the mother, even the suspect. And yet, to our knowledge, the Amber Alert never went out in Spanish. We want to and need to change that. It's also important to point out that the majority of stations are able to essentially multiply the state funding through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. In other words, when the stations get more money from state grants, they can get more federal money. Of course, the reverse is true. If state funding drops, so does the federal funding. As our records have demonstrated, since the inception of state community service grants and equipment grants, the AMPER stations have been and will continue to be excellent stewards of these funds. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we thank you for your continued support, and we are available for any questions.
Questions? If not, Mr. Glazier, Ms. Montgomery, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Good presentation. Thank you. All right, and lastly, Minnesota Public Television with Jim Pallarini and Bill Straczynski. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank
Got
you,
a
Mr.
Chairman. DVD player moving into place.
It has. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bill Straczynski, and I represent the Friends of Minnesota Public Television and have for well over 30 years. Mr. Pallarino will deliver the bulk of the testimony, all of it basically, except I want to make a statement that public television has been a beneficiary and a partner with the state of Minnesota going back to 1956, and the first grant was made to Channel 2 as an educational television station. And these grants programs you have before you have been around since certainly the 1970s. We appreciate our strong relationship with the state of Minnesota and look forward to continuing that. We do have a budget request, which will deal with increase in funds, which we'll deal with at a later time, as I understand, Mr. Chairman. But anyhow, Mr. Pallarini.
Thank you, Bill. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Pallarini, and I'm the president of Twin Cities Public Television here in St. Paul. But today I'm representing the entire Minnesota Public Television Association, which includes five other stations that serve the state of Minnesota. So I just have about 5 or 6 minutes of comments. Then we have about a four-minute video we'd like to play for you that shows you some of the work that's been happening throughout the state in public television. But my guess is that PBS has probably touched your lives, each of your lives in some way, whether it's through your children or your grandkids who tune to public television for the best educational programming that you can find anywhere. I know a number of you, maybe all of you, have been on the Almanac couch from time to time with Eric and Kathy, where I think you would agree you're treated fairly and with an open, candid kind of discussion over tough issues. Also bet that some of you may have been hooked on Downton Abbey over the last couple of months, which is just an incredible British drama that we were able to bring and share with this country. So I'm assuming you know a little bit about what we do. But from time to time, I always like to take a step back and remind us how public television came to be and why we seek public support for what we do. I mean, to answer one of the questions that was raised earlier this afternoon. You might be surprised that one of the biggest advocates for public television in the state of Minnesota is Stanley Hubbard of Hubbard Broadcasting. And I have been on many fundraising calls with Stanley where I sit back and I love to hear him say, I'm a big supporter of public media because they do things that we can't do in commercial television. And what Stanley recognizes is that television is the most powerful educational tool that we have in our society today. And there needs to be a group of people like Stanley and his family who can innovate, create jobs, and operate in a free marketplace. But there also needs to be people like those in public television who will use the power of television first and foremost for public service and not for profit. In a famous speech that the FCC Commissioner Newton Minow made in the 1960s, where he coined the phrase talking about television, describing it as a vast wasteland, he also said about television, when we aim at the bottom line, we aim too low. And in the 1950s, Congress also recognized that well and created non-commercial television. And they specifically charged public television stations with the responsibility to preserve forever an opportunity for all citizens to have access to non-commercial media in order to provide a free exchange of information and ideas essential for our democracy. While in other industrialized and civilized countries, non-commercial television is fully funded by tax dollars or license fees, in this country, we are funded through a fragile public-private partnership. And I say fragile because this public-private partnership, in this partnership, each party needs to do its part, and that's why we're here today to talk to you. Public television is organized differently than public radio in the state, in that it's made up of six separate organizations, each with its own staff, each with its own local boards, and they're independently controlled, serving the unique needs of the regions of the state. We're geographically separate, but we work closely together, and we're interconnected by the state's fiber system so we can broadcast programs statewide when we need to. And although we're independent, we have a shared purpose, which is use the power of television for the public good. And some examples of these activities are providing lifelong learning opportunities. We do a lot of partnerships with government agencies and nonprofit organizations to help them achieve their mission and purpose. We produce news and public affairs programming where civil discussions can take place about the pressing issues of our time. And we provide a safe educational learning environment to prepare kids for school. And we strive to be a local voice throughout the state. Public television is most definitely not dominated by the metro area, and it's facilitated by the fact that each regional PBS station is independent. And a good example is the Lakeland Public Television, which operates transmitters in Brainerd and Bemidji, and they serve a vast geographic region in the north-central Minnesota from Little Falls to the Canadian border. They serve some of the poorest, most rural counties in the state. And remarkably, that station is the only only station that would ever produce a nightly news show to serve the needs of people living in that region. We also partner with the state government to inform its citizens in meeting its mission and serving Minnesotans. An example of the statewide work that we do is the Minnesota Channel, which is covered by all Minnesota public television stations. And in addition to educational and informational programming produced locally right here in Minnesota, the channel delivers gavel-to-gavel state House and Senate proceedings, which promote government transparency and encourages citizen engagement with the political process. Before we formed the partnership to broadcast state government statewide, it was only available in a few areas and only available by paid cable. And as I mentioned earlier, the funding of our nation's non-commercial television system comes from a variety of sources, and state governments have always played a very key role to support their local PBS station. For many years, and this may surprise you, state government was the second largest supporter of public television next to individual contributions. So many states have played critical roles by providing operating and capital grants. And over the years, as Bill has said, you have played a very, very important role in making Minnesota public television stations strong. One of the things we've included in your packet is a comparison of Minnesota and some neighboring states in the per capita investment in public television. And not only do the grants help support some of our basic operations and services, they leverage other donations as well. The grants we receive from the state are matching grants, and they are not released until we can demonstrate other funds have been raised. And in addition to leveraging gifts from individuals, foundations, and corporations, the state grants also increase the federal grants that come to Minnesota PBS Station. So as with Joel, the bigger the state grant, the bigger the grant we get from the feds. So before we show you the four-minute tape, just to recap a few facts about Minnesota Public Television. Our mission is all about enriching the lives of individuals and strengthening our communities through the power of media. We focus our programming on advancing education, our culture, history and heritage, and civic engagement. Every Minnesota has access to our programs and services for free. And contrary to what some people perceive, the audience of public television exactly mirrors the audience of Minnesota. It doesn't skew more highly educated or higher income. We touch every citizen in the state of Minnesota. Public television also provides educational services to over 275 school districts and 192,000 students. And finally, there's perhaps no other investment of state funds that benefits as many people as does the investment in Minnesota PBS. We serve more people more often than any other cultural or educational organization in Minnesota, more than the public schools and universities, more than any museum or park. In just 1 week, 2.5 million people turn to their PBS station to be educated, entertained, and inspired. So thank you again for taking the time to listen to me talk about public television. You could tell after 30-plus years of working in this world, I'm as passionate about it as I ever was. We have greatly appreciated your support and your consideration for continued support of Minnesota PBS during this session.
Thank you, Mr. Pellerini. I have a question from Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One comment and then a couple of questions.
Sure.
The Brainerd Lakes area is very well served by Lakeland TV. Certainly up there's no other TV stations for news and for some of those other things. So I think you're doing a good job, at least up there. I do have two questions on this chart. Do you know what Minnesota's numbers would be if you added the legacy funding in? I realize it can only be used for certain programs, but where would we be if you added those numbers in?
Yeah, I do not, but we can get you that information.
Okay, because I think it would look a little bit better, Mr. Chair. And then if you don't have that one, what is the national average? Because many of these states I'm looking at, they're even more rural than Minnesota is. And, that's where the need is, I think, critical. And that's, so where do we stand if we compared all states?
Mr. Pellerini.
Thank you. I will get you that information as well. I don't know. I don't know offhand.
All right.
Good question.
Senator Dietzen.
I was just going to say, I'm sure that would be a parent committee that would be helpful.
Do that, Mr. Pellerini? That would
yes.
be great. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the matching grant that you get from the feds?
It's
Pellerini.
I'm sorry. Thank you. I'll speak for how it works in television, since that's what I'm familiar with. It comes through Congress to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and they're called community service grants, which are unrestricted grants that come to stations specifically to provide local services. The way the match works in television is for about every, I think it's now six or seven of non-federal dollars raised, you get basically an additional dollar in your federal grant. So it's that kind of matching formula. It's a matching formula against non-federal funding raised.
So, Mr. Chair, what is our grant that we've gotten for this last biennium from the feds?
Mr. Pellerini.
Varies station by station. Our grant, because of the amount of money we raise this fiscal year, is in the neighborhood of $2.2 million. For most of the other stations, actually, the way the grant formula works, it tends to favor the smaller stations. The smallest station in the state, which is in Austin, I think gets about $600,000.
Thank you.
Other questions? If not, continue.
Well, we then can show you the video that we prepared of some of the work that's been happening at Minnesota PBS.
And this is the place where people from every culture,
and community come together, where something that could have been really a huge, huge problem that had implications for blocks around it is now sort of a shining star.
When I'm dancing with my regalia on, I feel so proud. I feel strong as a Native American woman, and I just feel really proud about my daughter, too, because she, as well as dancing, and I know she's feeling the same feeling, that we're not only dancing for ourselves, our family, but we're dancing for our people. But from a student perspective, it was, wow, we get to miss summer, we get 2 weeks out from summer vacation. That was a big problem. But even though I was skeptical at first, it ended up working out really well for me because I'm doing PSEO, which is college work. I feel hopeful now because of what I've seen happening in communities of color led by young people about the possibility of change.
We need more grain today than we've ever needed. In the next 50 years, we need to produce as much food as what we have produced in the entire history of the human race.
I think that they have to realize we've come a long way here to make a living. I mean, and this is, we're basically, you know, homeless waste around right now that's often and has.
National research shows putting a first-time offender in detention might be the worst thing you can do.
If you take a kid who's new to the system, who's relatively low risk, the bad kids are going to rub off on the good kid, not the other way around.
On November 8, 1924, the West Lumber Yard caught fire, causing a loss of thousands of board feet of market-ready lumber.
And the fire was so hot they had to close the Midway Drive. And they had to go all the way around Lake Irvin to get to town.
I have one concussion on file. Do I believe I probably had more? Yeah.
This is a much more serious issue than we thought it was just a few years ago.
Food is something that we all share an interest in. We think of our population becoming more healthy and more wealthy and wise. Why wouldn't we want to do that?
Have you told your children what you want at the end of life?
My sons?
Are you kidding me?
No, honey. I'm trying to get what I want while I'm on this side of glory out of them.
Are you kidding? You know I haven't had that conversation. Girl, they're not ready. What?
Well, nobody's ready. I wasn't ready when you told me about it. Remember?
Yes.
Look, your children need to know what you want.
Tell them it's your living will.
So when I walk down the street, I don't just see, well, there's some buildings, there's some streets. So there's just all these hidden stories. And once you start looking at this stuff, you want to know.
The repeal of Prohibition also allowed for the opening of bars across the country. In the town of Gek, in the southwest corner of Minnesota, the Silver Dollar Bar was known for getting the first liquor license in Minnesota in 1934.
Welcome back to Almanac at the Capitol. We're live in the House Gallery, as we are each and every Wednesday night throughout the legislative session.
We went out on our own to try and start kind of an FFA-type program in Afghanistan. We went and we talked to the school directors and education ministers, and everybody from that side of the house supports it.
That's just an example of some of the work that's happened over about the last year, very focused on telling Minnesota's story and raising some very important issues that we all need to be a part of solving and addressing. Thank you.
Do we have any other questions for the testifiers? If not, thank you both for coming today.
Chairman,
we appreciate it.
Members of the committee.
Any input from anybody? If not, Thursday's meeting agenda is going to be an overview of governor's budget recommendations for the Attorney General's Office, Indian Affairs Council, Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board, and the Racing Commission. That, if there's no other business, means adjourned.